All right, this is Karen Brewster, and today is April 18th, 2022. And I'm here with Bill Schneider, and we are doing an interview with Irene Rowan via Zoom. Bill and I are in Fairbanks, and Irene, I don't know where you are.
Anchorage,
all right. And this is for the ANSCA Project Jukebox Project. So thank you, Irene, for taking time to join us today. And Bill, take it away.
Let's start maybe, Irene, with give listeners some idea of your background and your where you grew up, and so that we know, so that they have some sort of basis to place you.
Okay. Thank you for having me today. This is exciting. Very frightening at the same time. I need to rely on my memory. I was born and raised in the community of Haines, Alaska. My mother was from the village of Kotlong, and my father was a soldier stationed at Port Chilkoot. So we basically lived in Haines. But my mother was a leader in the village of Kotlong, so I spent a lot of my childhood in the village, while she did her work. I grew up with the traditional lifestyle of having to, what we call, put up food for the winter. And so as soon as it started getting light, we were out there picking seaweed, or during that season, then we went into all the berries. We picked every type of berry there was to pick, and then we, my dad would catch the fish, and we would cut it up and put it in the smokehouse and prepare it for winter. And then in the fall time, my mom would go to various conventions or meetings of other major Alaska Native groups, and she would trade foods. So she would come home with, dried herring eggs and black seaweed and other things that we didn't have in our area. So that basically, so we were very fortunate as a family, because we never were without food. My mother made certain of that. I attended the Haines school system. Once I graduated from Haines High School, I believe the superintendent had gone to my parents and said that I was going to Minot State Teachers College with his daughter Sharon, and I believe he filled out my application. Anyway, the next thing I knew, I wanted to join the Air Force, but to become a pilot. But my parents thought that the superintendent knew best, and so I ended up in Minot, North Dakota for a year, and absolutely loved it. And my friend didn't like it, so we transferred to Western Washington in Bellingham, and that's where I got my degree in business education. After graduating, I went off to Bethel as a new teacher, and it was, wow, it was such a eye-opener for me. I had never, I had been to Anchorage, but I had never been out to the tundra area. I had studied the tundra in economic courses, but I had never walked on it, nor had I experienced that whole type of lifestyle. So it was very exciting to be out there. And so I was a teacher in Bethel for about 3 years. And while I was out there, I got married and I had my first child. And then moved into Anchorage and worked in many different positions after that. I ran a public opinion firm here in Anchorage for a number of years. And so I knew basically what was happening politically around the state, because I had interviewers all over the state. And so I was very up to speed on what was happening politically. And then later, of course, got involved as a Village Corporation president with the Clean Land Claims, and worked for EFN and worked for the Department of Interior and owned and operated my own company for a number of years. Mm-hmm. That's it.
In a nutshell. What took you to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I, at the time, was married, and my husband had run the primary campaign for Mike Gravel. And Mike Gravel, of course, won the general election and once and asked if we would go back to Washington, D.C. To work with him. And so my husband was assigned the task of the land claims as a staff person to Senator Gravel.
Wow. And you obviously were heavily involved in that.
Yes. Yes. I can't give you the details because I don't remember all the details, but in the beginning I was there for many of the social gatherings because I had two little girls, and so my primary concern at the time were my daughters. So
sure.
But I entertained and visited and that type of thing. So
And who were some of the people that you thought were most important in terms of your work at that time in D.C. that you came into contact with and you considered important?
Well, a number of social gatherings when Alaskans came into Washington, D.C., whether they were native or non-native. So but the people I recall spending most of the time with were people like John Barbridge, who was then the president of the Clinton and Haida Central Council. And to me, he was absolutely magnificent. He was just an extraordinary man. His voice was, and he had such stature. He had this booming voice, and so very articulate in the Claims Act and in the Native people. And he was just an absolute awesome leader, Native representative, I believe. So he was, to me, a real hero. Bill Van Ness was chairman of the chief of staff to the Interior Committee, Senate Interior Committee. So I used to enjoy talking with him about what was going on. And then, of course, there was a person over in the House. His name was Frank Ducheneau, and he was the staff person for the Indian Affairs Committee in the House. And so he would be at a lot of the gatherings. And so it was always fun to talk with him about what was happening. And then people coming down from Alaska, of course, were Willie Hensley and Emil Naughty and Ray Christensen from Bethel, who I knew very well because of my days in Bethel. Joe Upixson, Charlie Edwardson. And then I met a young man by the name of Tommy Richards, and he was originally from Kotzebue, and I believe he worked for the Navy Intelligence Agency. I'm not really sure, but he was in the Navy and stationed there in Washington, D.C., and became the reporter for the Tundra Times. But he was young and vivacious and just fun to be around. So, and he could play pinochle. So we all had a number of pinochle games together, when with other people that were from Alaska. Of course, you know, Alaska and the rural areas, you play a lot of pinochle. So it was really fun, you know, gave a touch of home back in Washington.
Yeah. It sounds like your home was a gathering place of sorts for folks coming from Alaska and also in from D.C. folks that were working on the issues. Is that a correct assessment?
No, because when I first moved to Washington, I moved about three times. The first time we lived on Admiral Hill, I called it Admiral Hill, and it was up by the airport across the river. And it was easy for people to come to. So I had, you know, I had some guests there, would have dinner parties there with introducing Alaska Natives to people like Joe Rothstein, who worked, you know, as the chief of staff for Senator Gravel. And so it was important for these people to get to know one another in the comfortable setting. So I had, you know, a few dinner parties there. Then we moved to Southwest Washington. And it was, you have to remember that this was the era of the civil unrest in our country. And when I first moved to Washington, D.C., I stayed with the Gravels. And to get anywhere, you had to go through the 14th Street area where they had the major uprising and the burning of buildings and whatnot. So there was that whole reminder of the civil unrest in that area. And so, well, when I lived in Virginia, it was fine. I was away from that type of scene. But we moved into Southwest Washington, and it was known as the shopping center for the poor. And it was also, so we had the civil unrest, and we also had the Vietnam protests. So it was crazy. I would look out my window. My window overlooked the road system, M Street. And I'd look out, and I would see a jeep of soldiers driving by, you know, four or five soldiers in a jeep going by. And then I'd look out later, and I would see policemen, you know, walking down, four or five of the policemen walking down the middle of the street. And then I'd look back, and you'd see a big, you know, another big jeep of soldiers going by, and then other types of police cars. So this happened daily, you know, and with all of these military and police people going by my street, I felt like I was in a war zone. Because that's what I saw every day. And so it was a very unsettling place. And so I really didn't have many Alaskans visit in that era or in that area because it was crazy. And then I moved out to the suburbs, and once I moved out there, it was like, I only had a couple times where I had gatherings for Alaskans. But I did have people come over, like Tommy, and there was another woman named Anna McAleer, and she was very involved from Unalakleet, and was a real, true advocate and a real helper for people who came down from the north. So we would have our pinochle games there.
What sort of needs did those people have that she was helping them with?
She would, like, people would come down, and this gets into the Alaskans for the Potomac, okay? So we started meeting at her apartment to talk about what could we do to help the people who were coming down. And so we arranged to have an office put at in the NCAI building so that people could be there to, you know, to do whatever work they had to do. And we had people who volunteered for typing of any materials they may have. And we had people who would guide them around the city, help them find hotel rooms, restaurants, things of this nature. You know, sometimes walk with them or visit senators or congressmen when it was needed, that type of thing.
Wow. That's neat that you provided that type of service.
Yes, and then we tried to, Tommy Richards was a major player with the Alaskans on the Potomac. And of course, like I said, he wrote many of the stories for the Tundra Times about the legislation and what was happening in Washington. And so he always had interesting reports for our meetings and, you know, gave us ideas about what we could do to help and maybe who they should talk, the Alaskans coming down should talk to or what they should do, that type of thing as well. And one time, the Tundra Times during that era would have the Tundra Times banquet, and they would invite various guest speakers. For a number of years, Buffy St. Marie was always invited to sing. So she was absolutely incredible and was a real Indian hero at the time. But one year they decided to have Jean Dixon, the psychic, come up to speak at the Tundra Times convention, or at the Tundra Times banquet after the AFN convention. And so Tommy asked me to go interview her with him when they went over to. And so we go over to her office. And we sit down, and she looks at me, and she says, "You and your husband are traveling in different circles, and you are going to be divorced. You are getting a divorce." Tommy just about fell out of his chair. He didn't know what to do, because that's not why we were there. But she decided to give me a reading at the time. So I don't know if she was confused that she should do a reading for me but anyway, luckily Tommy took control and started asking her questions about her feelings about the Cleans Act, whether or not it would pass. And she said yes.
So she was right about that.
yeah. Well, then she was right about my divorce too. So anyway, that happened. So it was totally unexpected. I hadn't thought about that. You never think about that. And then, wow. So.
that's all great information about the activities back there and the types of services you were able to provide. Because I've always wondered what it was like for people to leave Alaska, who had never really spent much time in an urban setting, and step off the airplane in D.C.
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, and you had many people come down that had never been out of the state before, so, and were not that familiar with the English language, so to speak. So it was very... So Anna was very good. She and her husband were very good about guiding those individuals through the city, you know, helping them find their hotel and learn to operate the elevator or the escalator or whatever, you know, and where to have meals and you know, types of clothes to wear and whatnot. And she would laugh and she'd say, "Well, you know, last night, so-and-so from so-and, you know, Barrow called and said, you know, can you come and pick me up? I'm lost. And so they would get in the car and they would go and find the person. And some, you know, and so she'd say things like, oh, so-and-so called last night and they wanted to be picked up. And we asked, well, where are you? And the person said, I'm on the corner of don't walk and don't walk. So, you know, we some of them had their problems, but basically, I think it was okay. They managed to survive. No one got, you know, terribly lost. They were always found. So,
yeah, and certainly the folks that did go back to Washington had a big impact in terms of the senators and the other congressmen.
Yes, they really did. You know, Alaskans were totally knew anything about Alaska, let alone Alaska Natives. So it was a real eye-opener for many of the senators and congressmen and staff people. You really met mostly with staff people, you know, yes. Staff of the senators. And so it was a real learning experience. Because when Washington basically speaks a very different language than you do here in Alaska. Hmm? They have their own, everybody has their own type of language. You know, they talk about public law, they talk about public law 95, 638, this type of thing, you know. So there was a real language barrier in many cases.
I can see that.
But you always had someone in the group that was very, very articulate and so was able and effective in getting the message across.
Yeah. Looking back at Mike Gravel and his impact on ANCSA, how would you evaluate that?
He was a true advocate. You know, Mike Gravel realized he would not be a senator without the support of the rural areas. And basically, he really did seek the rural area out because and when he went and met many of the people in the rural areas, he knew that the land was very important to the people and education. So he wanted to assist in that area. So his heart was really with rural Alaska, and with Alaska, in making it a better place, because there was a lot of work that had to be done. And I would say that he was really, really very instrumental in getting a lot of the provisions in place. I remember we had discussions about whether or not, about the role of the federal government, if the land claims passed, what role should the government play? Should they have the land? Should we have reservations like they do in the lower 48? You know, or should it be a different system? So we had, you know, discussions like that, and some major policy discussions were just around the dinner table. So he would take those and he would, you know, if he agreed, then that was his position in many of the topics. He was very loyal to the Alaska Natives. There was a period there that the governor and I think other members had made an agreement and that with the Alaska Native, and so everyone felt comfortable about the agreement that had been made. And so they get in the plane, and or they're getting ready to take off. And one of the key senators, Senator Jackson, was on his way to Chicago after this one particular meeting. And during the meeting, Gravel discovered or learned that they basically did not tell the truth, that they were not going to abide by the agreement that was made with the Alaska Natives. And so he called the leadership of AFN that was still there in Washington and told them what, you know, what was going on. And they immediately called Senator Jackson, and Senator Jackson flew back from Chicago to meet with that group again and set the record straight that this was the direction they had agreed upon, and that's the way they were going. So he, you know, saved the Alaska Native position in that particular meeting. And so there were times that he and Senator Stevens didn't always agree on certain positions. And so it was a Democratic Congress, so he was able to get things through.
Do you remember some of the issues that they disagreed on?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, I know from my own standpoint, you know, it was Indian, you know, it was the role of what you call tribes today, you know, what was their, you know, land in trust.
Uh-huh.
The federal government oversight, the role of the federal government basically was, you know, was one of the key areas.
And what was Gravel's position on that?
Gravel sided with the Alaska Natives, and that was, and he had Byron Mallott, who I remember worked for Mike Gravel, and Byron, you know, his position, and Mike's position too, in his book, I believe, his book about the chapter on the Claims Act, believed that, you know, there should be no reservation. It should not have the oversight of the BIA, because looking at what had happened in the Lower 48, with the Lower 48 Indians, would certainly not be beneficial for Alaska Natives. And so he felt that the Alaska Natives should be in a position to articulate what it is that they want and what they feel they need. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe in the federal government oversight. He didn't believe in reservations, let's say.
Yeah.
So in that respect, that was one of the major issues that we talked about. And was written in his book. And Byron would always say, if, you know, let us be our own, let us make our own decisions. If we make a mistake, it's our mistake. Type
mm-hmm.
attitude, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
We were controlling destiny.
So Byron was actually on Gravel's staff at that time?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he came down and was a legislative. Yes, he worked on the legislation in the Washington office. But then when Alaska, you know, under the war on poverty was going on, right? Remember that war on poverty? And so a lot of programs were coming into being in Alaska, and Rural CAP was really starting to grow. And then I believe it was Willie Hensley who had convinced Governor Hickel to use that group as the sounding board or for as a task force in developing some of the language that's in the Claims Act. So the WorldCap was made up of representatives throughout Alaska, and basically it became the leaders of the various regions that sat on that board. And so Governor Hickel used that board to help put the state position together. And Byron went to work for that group.
Who did?
Byron. He left Senator Gravel's office to run that agency.
Uh-huh. And so you stayed in Washington throughout the land claims period, or did you return to Alaska before it was culminated?
Well, I returned to Alaska with it was October or November. I think it was November. The Claims Act passed, and there were a lot of Alaska Natives there in Washington, and there was a large gathering. And there was this huge gathering at one of the Capitol rooms. And so I went into the city to attend the gathering, and it was a happy affair that it was over and done with. I remember the leadership, you know, a lot of the people were beginning, particularly Charlie Edwardson, saying that, you know, we're going to get some of our land back, but it's going to cause us problems, and that in many respects, the Claims Act was going to be pitting us against each other. That it had that direction. That could be the direction that it could go. And if you look at the Claims Act, there are, you know, provisions in there that do pit, you know, villages against regions, and maybe regions against regions, and, you know, the division of land and portions of the Settlement Act. There was, you know, the whole question of, wow, will we keep it together? Will we still maintain our relationship as Alaska Native, as a unified Alaska Native group, or will we begin fighting?
So after that gathering, then you heard.
At that gathering, there were people from, of course, from home that were there. You know, Byron said, Irene, it's time for you to come home. Willie said, oh, come on now. There's no reason for you to be down here, you know, and John Borbidge and Mike Bradner and all these other people saying that I should return to Alaska. And so I had no money. I had two little girls, a lot of responsibility, no money. I borrowed money from my friend and my brother and his wife were going on a trip and they needed a house sitter. So I came back to Alaska to house sit and left Washington.
Mm-hmm. Before we get you out of Washington, let me ask one more question about that period of time. How would you assess Etook Edwardson's impact on the Washington scene?
He was, you know, he was a real driving force. And while he did not agree with everything, he pushed the leadership into more thought, becoming more thoughtful, you know, and so he was always challenging whether or not that was a good decision or a bad decision or a good direction or a bad direction. And so he was a very challenging force with the leadership that was back, you know, that would come back. And So he also was very he was also very astute in knowing the political process in Washington. You know, who you should talk to and how to approach them. He was pretty effective. Woody likes to say, because he was so outspoken that, you know, oftentimes people preferred to work with, you know, another Alaska Native other than Charlie, because Charlie was so outspoken and bold and demanding. But I would say he was very effective in different ways.
Yeah.
He stopped Vice President Agnew at the airport and walked up to him and asked for his support. I can't remember exactly what the story is, but I remember that.
Yeah, that's pretty bold.
Okay, so you packed up the girls and headed back to, was it Anchorage or was it?
Yes, I came back to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get a job.
Why?
I don't know. They offered me a job at AFN as a part-time secretary.
Oh.
And so I said no thanks to that. And I was still married, basically, at the time. And so my Michael had set up this public opinion company. And so he set me up. He got a contract in Alaska. And so he hired me to manage the contract and so then I ran his business up here for a number of years.
Uh-huh. But didn't you...
So that's when I was...
Yeah.
Pardon?
I keep interrupting you. That's what you were up to then. Where does the work in Klukwan and setting up their corporation come in?
Okay, once the Klondike passed, we were all to enroll. I enrolled to Sea Alaska and identified Klukwan as my village, and so I became enrolled to Klukwan.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the enrollment, you know, then I discovered that, you know, the Klukwan was not really a village corporation, but it had been a reservation or a reserve. Mm-hmm. And so there was this, the leadership of the Klukwan Inc. that was identified under the original Inksa of Klukwan Village, was basically a tribal government, and they really were not, the shareholders in 1973 voted to retain the reserve lands and not participate under INCSA.
Oh.
So they were a tribal government basically and remained so. And they had a membership of about 80 people, whereas 253 people had enrolled to Klukwan Inc. Or were enrolled to Klukwan Inc. And made shareholders by the government, of course. So I was one of the 253 and I didn't live in the village, so I was not a tribal member of the village. So a number of us were disenfranchised and were not benefiting from the Claims Act. And I kept asking the solicitor, the Department of Interior solicitor, every chance I went to all the gatherings that were meetings that were held here in Anchorage. And I would meet with the solicitor and I would ask him how I could become, how I could get out of the village of Klepwan. And every time he said, you can't. You're stuck with you. So I was stuck there. And then in 75, I went to Haines, and a number of people asked to get together. And this gets into my village corporation days now.
Yeah.
Is that what you're leading into?
Sure.
Okay. So in 1975, we got Haines, and I meet with a number of different shareholders, and we decide that we will ask the Klepwan board for a shareholder meeting so that we could, you know, elect officers. And we would ask the board, we would ask the shareholders to become a village corporation with Inc's benefits as opposed to the former reserve. So in June of 1975, nine of us were elected to the board, and after the board, they asked that I, they nominated me as the president of Klepwan Inc. And my task was to get us recognized as a village corporation under INCSA and to protect the Chilkat Indian Village IRA, their rights and land. Mm-hmm. So should I get into my story of being a village corporation president?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. So I'm elected and I'm living in Anchorage, and after the shareholders meeting in June, I go down to, and Donna Willard, my sister-in-law, had to help me talk with the people and the council in getting set up for the shareholders meeting. So she, after the meeting of the, and after the election, and we nominate the board, we nominate the officers of the corporation, we hire her as our corporate attorney. She was living in, she had just moved to Anchorage. So we were both living in Anchorage. And we stopped in Juneau on our way back and met with Don Borovich, the president of Sea Alaska, to let him know that we were the new leadership and that this was the direction we were going to go. And he said that he would be happy. Sea Alaska was very happy to help us and let him know what they could do. And he offered his Washington, D.C. council as something that we could use and recommended that we head to Washington to be included in the Omnibus Bill of 1976 that was being drafted. And so then we went over to the BIA and met with the area director, Clarence Antioquia, and Tommy Richards was then working there as well. So we met with them, and the BIA said they could give us some funds to travel to Washington to meet with the BIA to see whether or not there was a governmental solution to our mission of becoming a village corporation under INCSA. And so basically they came forward with the traveling funds. So we went back to Washington and the BIA said, no, there was no governmental authority to do that and recommended that we then visit our legislators at the time. So, of course, I go to Center for Cavell, and he assigns a guy by the name of Don Argentstinger to help me and with our legislation. And so then Don then directs us to meet with this and helps get us into Senator Stevens' office and to Congressman Young's office and then to the staff for the Interior Committee and staff in the House and in the Senate. So we then start our, you know, and then the Siraska attorney helps draft our legislation. So that's in the fall of 1975. And then we are, we do make the, we become Section 9 of the Omnibus Bill of 1976, which allows us to, you know, which allows us to become a village corporation. So in January of 76, we officially become a congressional, you know, we become a village corporation under INCSA. And the act required that we before we could become a village corporation with the INCSA benefits, we had to quit claim to the IRA the lands that had been given under INCSA. It was 800 acres of land, so we had to quit claim that land back to the IRA. And any monies we had received from any of those lands, because they had a lease agreement with the U.S. Steel, okay? So, and that's how we were able to get in under INCSA, because under 14G of INCSA, all existing agreements had to be, land agreements had to be acknowledged. And so the Choquette Indian Village had a lease agreement with U.S. Steel for exploring iron ore under the surface of the village area, which was signed by my mother. Can you believe that? Anyway, that lease, so that lease agreement had to be acknowledged, and that meant that Clutchman Inc. did not have any land, because it really belonged to the Choquette Indian Village. So, but it had been conveyed to the Clutchman Inc. And so that was why we had to quit claim the land back to the village, back to the IRA. So we did all of that, so that was part of the legislation. And then we had 1 year to select our land. So I come back to Alaska from that wonderful event, and that was in January of 1976. So then I, President Burbidge called me and said, listen, I'm sending staff up to help you get prepared as a village corporation. So he sends three staff members, and one was the attorney, another one was a shareholder relations person, and the third was the lands manager. And they spent a whole day telling me what I had to do. One day training. So it was like set up an accounting system, you know, begin the land claims process, like land selection process, issue stock certificates, things of that nature, everything that a corporation has to do. So I had to do all of that. So I had to get all of that done. And then talking about the how to relate to shareholders and how important it is that they be involved and understand their role. And then letting them know their rights and responsibilities, and then to issue stock and to have a shareholders meeting and all those other responsibilities to shareholders. And then the third, of course, was the land selection. And given the map of our withdrawal area and how to read the maps and all that around it. It was just incredible. It was like 8 hours, and it was just horrendous. So I had to, so they gave me all that information, and then I had to turn it around because I had to explain it all to the board. So the beginning of with Kokwani Inc. as an Inc. corporation is mostly in resolution form, because I had to do everything, but I did everything. I worked with the attorney in developing resolutions for the board to act on. So that was really hard, because we had to write the bylaws and, oh, you name it, we had to do it. So that we did, and then we're moving right along and discover in May that there is no land for us to select. I had hired a consulting firm to research the land status or land conveyance, our withdrawal area rather, in the Haines area where we were to select our lands. And then I had also hired my vice president of the corporation to work on the land selection. And his job was to go over to BLM and learn how to read the maps and, you know, what one has to do to be able to select the land. So I hired him, and he, very bright, and I knew that BLM would be very, would be the best learning area for him, because they would take the time to explain everything, which was very of the best thing I ever did, I think, for the corporation. Because he comes back and reports to me that there's no land to select, that the state of Alaska had been TA'd all the our area land in our area because it was outside the national forest. And it was the only land really available in Southeastern for them to select for their statehood entitlement. So we have no land. And the consultants come back and they say, no, it's wrong. He is wrong. And they were furious with me because I said, I'd like you to go back one more time and then give me another report. And so they went back and head down. So they said, you're wrong. There is no land to select. So I was again on the plane in June, I think it was, to get legislation to allow us to select land elsewhere in Southeastern. So I called up Senator Gravel's office, and then I made appointments with Gravel's office, Stevens' office, and Young's office, and the Interior Committee chief of staff, and I get to the committee chief, and he says, nope, sorry, Irene, we are not doing any more INCSA legislation this year. We had the big bill in January, and we're not doing anything anymore. That was the end. So I go back to Gravel's office, and at this time, there was this story that was breaking about this book about the secretary that couldn't type. You know, it was a big scandalous affair in Washington, D.C. And so, anyway, Gravel, I report to Gravel what the committee had said. Well, he said, okay, I'll stay the weekend, and he said, and plan to come out to my house on Sunday, and we'll talk some more. So we go out to the Gravel house on Sunday, and Sam Keto and Willie Hensley, as well as my vice president, Bill Thomas, and my attorney, Donna Willard, the five of us head out to the senator's home. And we're walking in the place, and of course there are TV cameras all over the place, you know, and filming as we walk in. It was quite funny. So we go in, and who should be there but Senator Haskell, Senator Bennett Johnston, that were part of the, they were chair and co-chair of the Interior Committee, and Lloyd Beads, who was chair of the House Indian Affairs Committee. We sit down and we have this wonderful meal prepared by my friend, by Rita Gravel. We sit down, and so Bennett Johnston looks over and says, okay, why are you here in Washington? Why are you down from Alaska? So I get to tell him my story, and I, you know, my woefulness of the no response from the committee chair, or chief of staff. And he said, well, okay. So he said, just call the office on and call him on Monday. So I said, okay. So I called him on Monday, and called the chief on Monday. And he said, I don't know what you said, don't know what you did, and I don't want to know, but okay, you can have your legislation. And so we gave him a copy of the legislation we wanted. And met with Senator Stevens and again Congressman Young, and let him know that we were going forward with the legislation to allow us to withdraw lands without to allow us to outside of our withdrawal area. So that, and then so then we leave, and that legislation is being worked on and going forward. And then I get a call from Roy Hundor, who is with us, who is president of SERI. And we had had lunch before, and SERI, of course, as you know, could not. The state had selected the majority of land in the Anchorage area, so he had no land to select here. But when I had gone, at some point along the way, the commissioner of DNR, Alaska Department of Natural Resources, called and said that he would be happy to make land available in the Haines area if I wanted to select there. And so I went over lunch. I told Roy that's what was offered by the commissioner. And so we have lunch, and we go our merry way. And then I get a call from the commissioner a couple of days later, saying that, oh dear, Irene, I misspoke. There is no land for you to take, and I can't give you land in the Haines area. So, turns out if they had allowed us to select their TA lands in Haines, then they also had to let Cook Inlet select in the Anchorage area. So, it wasn't in their best interest to have that happen. So anyways, so Roy said that they had some legislation that they were trying to get through allowing them to have a land exchange, and their legislative bill had been attached to a Park Service, some Park Service language, and that language was not going to pass the Senate, and so could they attach their language to our bill? And I said, well, if it wasn't a problem to the Interior Committee, I had no problems with it either. So, of course, I had to get permission from the board for that. So anyway, they became part of our legislation.
Wow.
So, and then finally, it's September, and boy, our legislation, Congressman Don Young had asked for unanimous consent of our legislation. Very exciting. And so the bill was coming up, and could we come back and do some work back there? And so I go back with my attorney, go back there. And Congressman Young says the legislation is going to be on the floor at noon tomorrow. And he was only waiting, he was waiting to hear from the Department of Agriculture, well, the Forest Service. He wanted to hear, he needed their position. If they objected, and then our legislation was dead. So he was hopeful that they would not object. But the language would be on the floor at 12 o'clock the next day. So then we go back to the hotel. I get a phone call from the commissioner from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources saying that they could no longer support the Klokman legislation. Sorry. We're pulling our support. So then a few minutes later, I get a call from the Department of Interior, and they sent their three people over from there to talk to me about what I was going to do. And I just said, I'm going forward. You know, we're this far, I'm not giving up. I get a call from Roy Hundorf asking if I would withdraw our language from the bill. And I said no, and that we were going to go forward. And so by then I'm an absolute wreck because this is, you know, 5:30, and the workday is over in Washington. And so, but it's still a time change difference for Alaska. So I call up the regional forester in Juneau and beg for his support in getting the Forest Service or the Department of Agriculture not to object. So anyway, we wait the night, and the next day we go up to the Hill, and we're standing there with Congressman Young waiting for action in half an hour. But meanwhile, at 11:30, the Forest Service comes up with a letter of no objection. So at noontime, our legislation passes.
Phew.
And then in October, it passes the Senate. So it passes the Senate. And so meantime, we have to scurry because we don't have much time left to complete our land selection. And Champion Timber had a lease on a little island called Long Island, and they gave the lease back to the Forest Service. And I got a call from the regional forester saying, hey, there's this land that is now available if you're interested. So my nephew worked with the Sea Alaska Forester, and they put together the land selection for that area. And so in January, we finish our land selection for the Long Island lands, and the board passes it. And so I'm absolutely thrilled. I was exhausted. I was tired, an absolute wreck by that time, for going through all these battles. But meanwhile, you know, I'd had a shareholders meeting too, and I just got to tell you about the shareholders meeting because it was a contentious meeting, and it was very difficult because the majority, my vice president and I were the only two members of the board of nine that did not speak fluent Tlingit. And we had a lot of, the majority of our shareholders were still Tlingit speakers. So all that had to be interpreted at the shareholders meeting because it was held in two languages. And it was a very contentious meeting, and my uncle and my mom got into a major fight, and so politically, family, everything, you know. So there was just a lot of pressure in the question, should we do this or should we not, blah, 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 you know. So anyway, in January, they adopt the land selection, and then they turn around and say, we no longer want you as our president. So.
Wow.
But I didn't have the authority to do what I did.
Oh,
But it was just political.
Yeah, right. So how did, what was going on with Siri? Was Siri still involved with you on that land selection?
Well, Siri, you know, they wrote their own legislation. They had an attorney that was, and they just put it as, you know, a rider to our legislation.
Oh, okay. So they were, they had other land that they would get.
Well, they it allowed them to do, you know, to trade lands. It allowed them to do other things.
Yeah.
It was a beginning. It was a beginning process for them and their whole land situation.
This is really interesting for us because it's one of the challenges that of ANCSA was those places where there wasn't land that could be selected, and just because of state selections and federal withdrawals and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting example.
So, yeah, let's see. That legislation was, where do I have it? It was 94 something or another, but it's in the Lanham's book, Bob Arnold.
Okay.
Yeah. So that part of the omnibus bill. That was its own separate bill.
Yes.
Okay.
It's public law 94-456. And it's October of
76.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, what did you do then, besides take a deep breath?
Well, okay. I made some major changes in my life. Before, let's see. And I, so in 75, I started a new company called Kishtu Inc. with Susan Reddy. And we formed this company to do public information dissemination. And we bid on the contract to do the public opinion, public affairs contract to reopen the enrollment for ANCSA. Mm-hmm. So we did the enrollment campaign, worldwide enrollment campaign. And it was the first time that two women had ever been given a contract of that size, money-wise. You know, women really weren't in business then. So,
wow.
So I did that. I was doing that. And then we did it. We had other contracts. So, and then after... Then after I, you know, healed from my whole drama of Klekmon, my friend that I had met while lobbying in Washington for the legislation, he had been working for the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate and was going to be starting his own company and did so, became the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs under the Carter administration. And he called me up and asked me to go to work for him on Alaska issues in Washington. And I said no. But then he came up to Alaska for an AFN convention and talked me into going back. So I became a special assistant for Alaska programs to the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in Washington, and became a member of the Alaska Task Force, which was preparing new regulations for the implementation of ANCSA and the beginning process of ANILCA, the Alaska National Indian Lands Conservation Act. So I was a part of that task force.
Huh. Wow.
And then came back to Alaska because my daughters did not like Washington. And so to keep the family together, I moved back to Anchorage and walked into AFN to say hello to Janie. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And she said, okay, start on Monday. So I went to work for AFN as their lands person in the implementation of ANILCA. So.
Can we talk a little bit more about the Alaska Task Force back in D.C. and your role in that?
The Alaska Task Force was basically made up, we were the staff people to the various assistant secretaries. As staff people, it was made up of a representative from energy, fish, wildlife, and parks, BLM, or land and water, and Indian Affairs, and I think there were three representatives from the secretary's office. Mm-hmm. And so, we were to, my interest was mostly on ANCSA, and to tell you the truth. And I was at a cocktail party, and the solicitor comes up to me, solicitor of the department, says, you know, I have all these lawsuits against me in Alaska. Can you help me get rid of them? And I said, well, okay, I can certainly try, but I got to ask my boss. And so I went over to his forest, and our solicitor, in-universe solicitor, was also there. So I went over, and I told Forrest what the solicitor had asked for, and he said, okay, sure. And the solicitor, the Indian Affairs solicitor, laughed, and he said, he would never ask you to do that. And I said, yes, well, he just did. Come on. So come with me. And we went over, and I asked the solicitor to repeat his request. And he did. And so the Indian Affairs solicitor had two attorneys working with me in solving a lot of the lawsuits that were before the department in various issues. And then we made agreement, you know, so we developed legislation that was that became part of ANILCA land treaties, like the whole Koenig legislation, which was there, some other pieces of legislation. So anyway, with the task force, I was able to, you know, take those pieces of those agreements to the task force and get them included as legislation. Pieces of legislation to be part of ANILCA. And subsistence was one of the major portions of ANILCA.
Would you talk about that and Title VIII and your involvement in it?
I had really no involvement.
Hmm.
My position. And I was accused by my boss of being paternalistic because I thought we had a chance for subsistence, you know, because I thought we had a really good chance of getting the support, and we had the support of the department, and I thought we could have stayed strong because one day, Guy, at one of our assistant secretary meetings, my boss, Forrest Gerard, the assistant secretary, was not always able to make the assistant secretary meetings. So he sent me in his stead. So I would sit at the table with assistant secretaries, with the undersecretary, discuss, you know, various issues. And so that was absolutely incredible, you know, sitting there and being an assistant secretary, basically. And so, anyway, we discussed a lot of issues there. I forgot where I was going with this.
Well, we're talking about subsistence. And,
so, sitting at that table, first, Guy Martin comes in and says, Ballista won the easement lawsuit. And the solicitor then announces that ANCSA is Indian law, and wherever possible, the department should support the position of the Indians.
Wow.
But the position of AFN was the rural residence language.
You mean in terms of rural residents having priority for subsistence?
Yes, rather than the Alaska Natives.
Yes, yeah. Well, including Alaska Natives, yeah.
But language.
The language, saying Alaska Natives versus rural residents.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I felt that there was not much I could do. You know, they had taken the state position, so I had to follow their lead, and so there was nothing I could do at the department.
So your position was that you preferred the Alaska Native language versus the rural resident language? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And can you explain why?
Because under the statehood legislation, of the Statehood Act, it said that the hunting and fishing rights would be decided at a later date, but it did recognize hunting and fishing rights of Alaska Natives.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, those rights would be discussed at a later date. And so here, you know, and it wasn't until ANILCA, or when it went before ANCSA, you know, that was one of the areas that they weren't able to agree on.
Right.
When they were talking about the ANCSA legislation. So it came up under ANILCA. So, and I really didn't like the word subsistence. I don't know what we could have said, traditional lifestyle, or I don't know. But anyway, so I think this, so the feds really didn't have much to say with it. I think it was more, we, you know, made little changes, like I thought that bartering was very important because we, you know, we traded foods, you know, in our area. My mom would trade red seaweed for black seaweed, you know. But instead of saying trading, they said barter, you know. And so there were word changes that I probably worked on, but nothing. The policy decision had been made. But I thought we could have, I thought we should have argued it more in the department because of the Chalista lawsuit and it becoming Indian law. But could we have overcome the state? I don't know. I don't know if we could have overruled the state position.
That certainly has become contentious with the dual management system and the federal government providing a rural subsistence preference, but the state not giving any segment of the population a priority under the act.
Mm-hmm. So my special legislation under ANILCA is allotments. I got to help write the language and walk it through the department, and getting all the assistant secretaries to approve it, and write the transmittal letter to the Hill. That was really fun.
A big job too.
Mm-hmm. But with the Alaska Task Force, we did, you know, those were some of the things that we did. We worked on certain issues that became part of ANILCA. But the Alaska Task Force also, you know, we were the agencies had put together EIS reports, and they would be like 2 inches thick. I mean, give me a break. So they would be delivered to my office at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I would have until the end of the business day to my comments on that report. And most of the time, it was just scanning, you know. I just remember that they wrote that there was nothing along the Yukon River. You know, it was this pristine river. And I said, hey, wait a minute, that's where, you know, you have boats running up and down that river. And then you even have that steamship there, not just whatever that tour company is that goes up and down that river. And so, but it was reviewing those reports and making comments. And then the comments, of course, had to go through the assistant secretary's office, and then they had to push them forward. But as a part of the Alaska staff group, Alaska Task Force, smaller task force, we worked on, you know, the specific language, and we worked with the different, I worked, you know, as well as land and water. On like the Nana people had language. I remember Bering Straits coming in to visit, the Chugach people, different Alaska groups would come in, and they would be asking for certain things, and I always had to have them leave paper because I really didn't understand a lot of what they were asking for, you know. And then I'd have to take those and argue their approval at the task force meetings. But it was exciting. It was a very exciting time. Let me tell you, I loved it. Loved the challenges.
Yeah. And so how long did that last? What was the next thing that you got into?
Well, then I came back to Alaska again, you know, and my daughters were very happy, and they were then getting much older and into those very difficult years of high school, you know. And so they needed a lot more time and attention. So I, you know, after I left, I left Washington, came back, went to work for AFN, and then went to work for the state, and then decided to go back to Clutwan Inc. And I went back and became the chairman of the board. And that was fun. We were really, it was great because I get to be, you know, the land. Remember the land, the Champion Timber. Lease sale. Mm-hmm. They had left behind these incredible trees. So I must admit that I was one of those guilty ones in having our corporation cut down those trees. But we were growing great guns. We had a tree cutting, where we were harvesting and road building. And then we did our own sorting, and we did our own stevedoring, and we did our sales of the logs. And so we had companies set up to do all of that. And then we also had a Little Mill in Washington. So we were doing really, really well because we controlled our trees from the ground up, and then we replanted. And so those trees are growing beautifully. Where we cut, they're now filled with wonderful trees. Mm-hmm. I left the board in 2000, and in about 2002, 2003, they went down. One of our companies, our construction company, and basically bankrupt the company.
So hard for businesses to maintain themselves, particularly in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. You know, but there were things that you know, and you look back at it, what more could you have done? I mean, being a teacher, right, and a business teacher, I always felt that it was important for the board members to know how to read financial reports. So I would have our financial manager have, you know, sessions before board meetings on financial reports, on reading financial reading and understanding financial reports, because I thought that was very important. You know, things that were very difficult, you know, I had, as chairman of the board, I was able to, bring in the, whether or not it was an attorney or the financial people or the land person, you know, bring them in to spend more time so that each board member understood exactly what it was that we were discussing and why, and, you know, form their own opinions as to how to resolve or how to go forward. But I don't think many of the boards did that. I think it's easier, you know, it certainly would have been easier for just management to come in, give us a report, and the board say yes or no. But I felt that it was important for our board members to know what they were voting on.
Well, over the years, you've certainly been a very strong supporter of ANCSA and the benefits of ANCSA. Could you comment some about the positive and negative aspects of the corporate solution that ANCSA provided?
Well, I can. Again, it's 50 years later, right? And I was very young and idealistic when I started. And I believe that we as Alaska Natives should have our land, and that was who we were. And you know, you go back and you know, you look at Willie Hensley, you look at Emil Nagy, you look at any of the leaders of the time. We were all the same. We grew up living off the land. That's what we had in common. You know, that was our, you know, my mom made us our clothes, our shoes were moccasins. You know, we had moose hide jackets. We had rabbit skin hats and mittens. And so we basically, you know, in the beginning, we all had that income that we lived off the land. That is no longer the case. So it's different in that respect. So my whole idealistic was, and I wanted, and another dream of mine was because of the old people. We'll call them the old people, all believed in education. They believed that the younger generation should go on to school and live as much as they could. And so education became very important. And you see then each of the corporations, the 12 corporations have foundations, and those foundations have set up the scholarship funds. So we all had that in common. So that education was very important to our elders. And therefore, each of the corporations set up a foundation to encourage shareholders to continue their education. So we now have a number of attorneys and doctors and professors and a lot of people with PhDs, and then so I thought, but we haven't really concentrated so much on the technical areas or in the skilled fields, which I think is where we really need to be. And this is what I found when I was the chairman of Kauffman Inc. Nana was so incredible. What they did with their shareholders is they wanted their shareholders to be the truck drivers and to be the people working in the field. And so they hired the unions to come in and teach their shareholders those skills, which was great. They didn't have to become, they didn't go union, but they used the union to teach the people the skills. And so when I get into Kauffman Inc., and we have all these truck driving positions, and we have graders, and we name it, we've got all these positions, and they're not filled by any of our shareholders. So I tried to get management to get a union person to come in and into Haines to teach our shareholders that wanted to learn to drive a truck, to give driving lessons, that type of thing. But I don't know, there are so many of those types of positions available, but I don't think we put enough emphasis on those for training purposes, because I know that in the past they had to go to Oregon or someplace else in order to get training to be a truck driver. But I think it's changed today, but I don't know. Some idealism of, yes, Alaska Natives should own the land, and luckily we own some of the land. Can we continue the ownership when we have shareholders that have never experienced living off the land and so don't have the same appreciation or value? That's rather frightening to me. We have a number of Alaska Natives who are top business leaders in the state. And we have people that are, standing on the street, that are homeless. And I look at that situation and I think, what can we do? And one thing that really bothers me is that, a lot of those people never had a full-time job, so they don't get Social Security. So what do they live on when they've never been able to have access to a full-time job or even a seasonal job that pays into Social Security? So they get to the age of retirement and there's, and they don't, like I said, many of them may have been a laborer because that's what they got in their community. But did they become the truck driver? Did they become those supervisory position holders? I don't think so, because I don't think they have the training. So we have a real, disparity between our shareholders. We have those that are well educated and those that have not had the same opportunities for work. And then I don't know what happened to the state. I don't know what happened to the educational system. When I was out in the Bethel area, you know, when I was a teacher out there, we complained about the getting students from the BIA schools that could not really read and write, you know? And then in 2000, umpteen years after I had left the Bethel region, I'm teaching a course, Native Perspectives, at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And my course, my students, the majority of my students are Alaska Natives. And I was absolutely shocked and appalled to hear their stories. And I keep thinking, why has Alaska not held its educators accountable? These kids would go to school. They told me that they went to school and their teachers, would come in, put the feet, a teacher would come in, put his feet on the desk and, start reading the paper. And they would sit there patiently waiting. And finally, they asked him one day, well, aren't you going to teach us anything? And he said, why? Why bother? You're not going anywhere. And this was in 2000, and I had been a teacher in the Bethel regions in the 60s. What happened? How can it still be happening today? Why are these children still being neglected? And why aren't the teachers being held accountable? You know, it just burns me. So, isn't it? You know, but the attitude, like, well, I had one student say, she was a freshman in college, and she had come from the Bristol Bay region, and she was light-skinned, and she was standing there, and the principal of the school was talking to a teacher, and the teacher was complaining about the students and their ignorance or stupidity. And then the principal says, don't get too excited. You know, they're not going to go anywhere. They're just Native people. And, I think, how can we put up with that? You know, luckily, I see a couple of my students as leaders today, and you can bet your bottom dollar that they don't put up with that kind of attitude anymore, and they're in very powerful positions, and I'm happy to see that.
Right.
But we need more people who will stand up and say, hey, state of Alaska, you are putting millions of dollars into rural education and you don't hold your people accountable? Give me a break.
Right. Right. Irene, let me ask you another question while the little time we have left. Megan Sullivan has talked a lot about the corporations and the issues involved with identification and how important corporations are or aren't in terms of Alaska Native identity. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I found that as time has been passing us by here, it was very easy in the beginning. I remember that as chairman of Clockman Inc., I gave an identification card to the shareholders saying that they were Clockman Inc. shareholders. Yeah. So that was very helpful so that they could use it for whatever purpose. But now you don't have the majority of young people being shareholders. So what kind of identity do they have? What do they use? Because they're not recognized as shareholders and they're not recognized as tribal members, because before you had to be one quarter or more to be a tribal member. So I don't know how, and then you have the urban rural issue. You know, is a person who lives in Anchorage or a person who lives in the village more traditional than a person who lives in an urban area? So it is an issue, and I don't know how I used in the old days when I was into the public information process, we used to identify traditional, transitional, and modern natives, you know. But I would say we don't really have traditional native today. We have more transitional and modern natives. And so they're going to have to come together for common areas of relating. And what that will be, I don't know. We had
talked before about, yeah.
So it is a problem.
You've talked before about your grandkids.
Mm-hmm. My grandkids, yes. My grandkids don't, you know, could not get descendant chairs from Sealaska because they weren't, they're not a quarter or more. So they weren't accepted. So I gave them shares, and my, you know, some of the shares that I had. So, and they're original shares. So they are now shareholders of Sealaska because of the original shares I had given. But they couldn't get them under, you know, because of the blood quantum, under the descendancy shares. So that's been a problem for them. But my grandson was a youth advisor to the Sealaska board, so that was pretty exciting for him. And my granddaughter got her degree, and it now works for a tribal government on St. Paul. So it's amazing, you know, but how they go back to our, you know, but they were raised as Tlingits rather than Irish, I guess.
So Irene, do you think the ASA corporations are going to address this shareholder and descendant issue, how they might address that in the future?
Some of them already have. You know, Calista, you don't have to, they do not require a blood quantum. I think the only two that require a blood quantum are, Doyon and Sealaska.
So the 1991 amendments where people born since 1971 solved some of that?
Yes. Now, but with the, we had a panel discussion on that. And Calista took the position from the 1991 amendments that they would enroll members in it. They did not have a blood quantum requirement. They have a descendancy. You have to prove your ancestors. So Sealaska, on the other hand, being very bureaucratic, took the blood quantum language, one quarter or more, for their descendancy, for their descendants. So they only allow those Alaska Native or those Tlingits or Haidas that have a quarter or more as descendants. So my grandchildren did not qualify. But now Sealaska is coming up with the vote to the shareholders, or a question to the shareholders, should they change that to become, should they change, get rid of the blood quantum requirement? Because to be an Alaska Native, we didn't we didn't have any way of measuring your blood quantum, right? So it's a Western requirement. So I would say that the majority
and I think
of people,
it's been pointed. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the end of your comment.
Oh, well, I know that it's been pointed out that in terms of Sea Alaska, that so many of the Alaska natives who are Tlingit living in Southeast Alaska now are less than one quarter native by blood quantum. So the population of native people is changing very rapidly in terms of physical makeup, if you want to say. But then the question is, are they any less native? Of course not.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, that's always been my feeling. You know, and that's basically what I was raised to believe. And you know, I came from a society that was discriminated. The Tlingits discriminated against my white blood, and then the whites, you know, discriminated against the native blood. So, you know, what are you? You know, you've got no identity whatsoever, not accepted in either society.
Well, you certainly have paved the way in multiple societies to greater understanding of people and their goals and their rights. And your career is exemplary.
Oh, thank you.
I had one other question. Karen, do you have another question?
I have a couple questions for clarification, but go ahead. Bill, you might want to turn off your video because your internet connection is spotty, and I think that's causing a delay while you and Irene are overlapping a bit.
Oh, okay.
See if that helps.
Okay. Is this better?
We'll find out. Go ahead.
Did I answer all your questions properly? I mean, do you feel I answered your questions?
Yes, you did.
I think with the identity question, my feeling is that it's the identity is based on how you were raised and what you believe. It doesn't have anything to do with blood. So I think we should do away with the blood quantum. Because it doesn't mean anything.
Right. Okay. And identification with the corporation being important for some people?
Yes. Yes, because, you know, I think that we have gone so far from the traditional way of life that as human beings, we like to have some type of identification, right? We want to be identified in some way or another, whether it's as an educator, as an Irishman, or whatever. But identification seems to be very important to people. And in the past, when I was growing up, you know, you identified by your clan, and you always, when you danced out, you know, you danced out with your back to the people, so that they would see on your regalia, your button blanket, the clan or the tribe that you belong to. So, you know, you always let people know in the beginning, in the traditional way, where you're from. Like, then they would identify, that's a clan person from that village or whatever. So So I think that the corporate identification is important, because a lot of the young people today, they may be experiencing prejudices in various areas, and it's a tool for them to have some type of to some sense of belonging.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But in the...
Yes, I do.
Is the clan and tribal affiliation still equally important?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh.
I mean, we're going to go through a celebration, but, you know... But it's no longer, it doesn't have the same importance that it had when I was growing up. It's different. And we, you know, you ask about the Claims Act. I mean, I think that what the Claims Act did was it brought such pride back to the people, the Native people. It gave them identity, a sense of identity, a sense of belonging. They belong to an organization. It did the renaissance of language and regalia and art and music and dance and instilled, you know, a lot of the traditional values of sharing and caring and taking care of the elders and things of that nature. So I think that's very, very good about, you know, the what many of the corporations have done, as well as encourage their shareholders to get educated. So from that standpoint, now we got to get the people into the jobs that they offer. And that they take over, they become the managers, that they become whatever, or they be able to get, you know. We had a shareholder hire law, or provision, no, policy. And that could always be very contentious. And I know that there's a lot of lip service paid to shareholder hire, but it hasn't been implemented to the fullest extent possible.
Right.
In Sea Alaska, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You have one more question?
Karen, you had some clarification.
Yeah. So you had mentioned with Klukwan the desire to become an Ayska corporation when there was the Chilkat Native Tribal Village organization. And I'm wondering why you felt the Ayska Village Corporation was something you wanted to pursue versus staying with the tribal system.
With to become an Ayska corporation, you are entitled for Southeastern, entitled to 23,040 acres of land. Under the former reserves status, Klukwan was entitled to 800 acres. That was the size of their reserve. Whereas with some of the other former reserve areas, they could have as much as 1 million acres of land. And so it was to their benefit to have fee simple title to 1 million acres of land, as to Klukwan's having the fee simple title to 800 acres. And that, so that the land was really an important area. for us, that we wanted 23,040 acres of land. And so we did get that. We returned the 800 acres plus to, because what we did is we picked in going through the conveyance process, the original conveyance process, before we became an Inc. corporation. BLM had given us some other lands so that it became something like 842 acres as opposed to the 800 acres. So they added some additional acres to the former reserve lands. And so that's why I say, 800 plus, because after the Claims Act, their land holdings did grow. And then they also picked up additional lands from the Nature Conservancy, for example. So I'm not really sure what their land is today. The other thing is that the Chilkat Indian Village has more governmental rather than economic direction. And ANCSA Village Corporations had an economic direction. And the village, Chilkat Indian Village, was had benefits for local residents. Whereas with the Village Corporation, it didn't matter where you lived, you benefited through the dividend system. So there are more benefits to be an ANCSA Village member. So in the end, those that lived in the village, they got a double whammy. They have the 800 acres plus the 2,040 acres.
Okay. And then does the village and the corporation, do they work together, collaborate on things, or how is that separated?
We tried to work together, and I think that where we could, we did, but because our membership is the same, but we never had any agreements or anything of that nature. But we certainly relied on the village for residents, for worker bees. And when I was chairman, I would travel to the village school, and I would talk to students there about the future and the importance of education and going to work for the corporation and the types of jobs that were needed and skills and this type of thing. Does that answer it?
Yes, that does. Thank you. My other point of clarification is the woman who sort of started the Alaskans for the Potomac, Anna, what was her last name?
Anna McAleer. McAleer. She just died last year.
Okay. And you said she was from Unalakleet originally.
Yes.
So, and you said you had an office at the NCAI building?
We had, they were setting aside an office for Alaskans to use.
And that's the National Council on American Indians? Is that, or National Congress?
Of American Indians.
Okay. Yes. So my question was, where did the funding come for that organization and all the work that they did to help people? I mean, some of it obviously was volunteer, but did they have some funding?
Alaskans on the Potomac or NCAI?
No, Alaskans on the Potomac.
Oh, no funding. No, we're all volunteers.
Okay.
You know, I just heard a little story about Anna McAleer. She was married to Dr. James McAleer. And Dr. McAleer was an absolute genius. He was working with a partner on DNA, in the discovery of DNA, and his partner beat him. By just a minute or so in the discovery, you know, of DNA. And his partner then committed suicide. He felt he had no more to do, that there's not much anything he could do in life, so he killed himself. So this really did start, you know, put a shock into Jim, and so he was so helpful, just incredibly helpful with the Claims Act, he and Anna, and taking people here and there, and they gave so much of themselves. It was incredible. He died, unfortunately, at an early age.
Well, certainly having all that support for people coming into D.C. must have been just so helpful and incredible.
Well, I think there were a lot of things that we didn't know, you know, and maybe we could have helped in different areas. And, you know, and I hear from people today that how they all had to share a hotel room, you know. We had extra bedrooms in our house that we could have used, or we could have made available for people if they could, you know, find their way back to the Capitol. But, so our communication wasn't always that great, I guess. And understand, maybe they just didn't want to tell us they didn't have money, I don't know. But I think we could have housed people. Helped housing. We could have done more.
It sounds like you did a lot. Well, I think we should close out the interview at this point. Usually we run no more than 2 hours. But Irene, this has been really helpful, and I know there's lots more that you you have to share. But I really appreciate your spending the time and giving us this interview. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I don't usually like to talk about it because I can't, like I said, you know, what did I experience? And because it was so long ago and one thing that has come very clear to me recently is that the younger generation that have taken over don't really want to hear from us older people. I think we did a lot of good things.
Yeah.
But they don't call on us for anything. And I don't know why. But anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I'm finding today. And so they're trying to reinvent history. And I went back today and thank you, because I went back and I reread a chapter on rebuilding of Kluckman, on the building of Kluckman Inc. And boy, I find that I left so much out. And I didn't tell you all that happened, but in pretty much.
Well, as you say, it can be hard to remember all those details, and each time you remember something different, I'm sure.
Yes. Yes.
What was that you wrote? Is that something that we could access?
It's not finished.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. My daughter and I have been writing a book for years called Along the Chilkat, and we basically talk about, you know, our Clinton values and how we were raised and whatever. And I don't know, this is not part of the interview, right?
Oh, let me turn off the recording then. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Recording stopped.